That's Segundo here, and I'm feeling a tad triumphant. You see, this week's guest, Mary Gateskill, has authored a book called Veronica, about a woman dying of hepatitis. Now, I hadn't heard of this hepatitis thing before. At first, I believed it to be a sexually transmitted disease. Now, I once caught the clap in 1982. I'm on the ball. These things concern me. But a man by the motel swimming pool, who told me he was a doctor and had the stethoscope to prove it, informed me that this wasn't the case at all. That, in fact, I could get hepatitis because of my drinking habits, which are, apparently, a tad heavy. But this kind man offered me a pill for only $50 that would prevent me from contracting hepatitis for the rest of my days. And now, dear listeners, I'm as pleased as a shot of añejo to tell you that I, Bat Segundo, will never get hepatitis, and I will continue to drink as much as I please, dammit, perhaps with a few sleeping pills to smooth things over. It's too bad the character in this little novel of Gateskill's didn't have the good fortune to run into a kind-hearted doctor. It's a good thing I'm sometimes wise enough to rely on the kindness of strangers.
So I am here with Mary Gateskill, author of Veronica, Bad Behavior, a number of actually really fascinating books. I'm honored to actually talk with her. Mary, how are you doing?
I'm okay.
You're okay?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. What can we do to make you better?
You needn't concern yourself with that.
Oh, okay.
It's not your job.
All right.
Okay is good.
Do you find yourself regularly sort of okay when you write these books, or on average?
What do you mean?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I'm just wondering. Oh, never mind. I don't know, because your books often deal with sort of doom and gloom and really sort of sad things. Do you find yourself sort of occupying an emotional state of okay, or?
I wouldn't say that doom is exactly their subject. Most of the characters aren't doomed. Veronica is,
yeah.
In the literal sense, but, you know, everybody's doomed in that particular way. But when I'm writing, I mean, it takes quite a long time to write a book. You go through a lot of different emotional states, and your state isn't necessarily mirrored by the character. You have to be very open and receptive to a lot of emotional flux. It's not about, you don't necessarily write sad because you feel sad, or probably write happy because you feel happy. What's that Mark Twain saying? There's no comedians in heaven.
Yeah. Very true, very true. Do you find yourself often kind of, we'll get to the book, but I'm just kind of curious about the subject, do you find yourself kind of writing against emotion sometimes, the emotion that you're feeling?
No.
Okay. No.
I mean, unless, what you mean if I happen to be in a particular mood and I'm writing a different kind of story?
Yeah, I'm just
curious. Well, yeah, the mood that I happen to be in, I mean, sometimes if I may be writing a scene which is not about being unhappy, but if I'm unhappy, I could be said to be writing against it, but I don't sit down and try to write against whatever mood I'm in. I don't start out from that point of view.
Well, you set actually the early portion of this book, the structural part, in we got a train going on in the back, in Marin County, and I know that you had actually lived in the Bay Area during a portion of your life. I was wondering why you chose, I mean, Allison could have fled to any sort of antipodean West Coast kind of place. Why would you set it in Marin County? Why'd you?
Well, probably for the uninteresting reason that I lived in Marin for 3 years, and I did walk up Mount Tamalpais a lot, and down, back down. I knew the terrain,
yeah.
And I find it a spectacularly beautiful walk, or it was. I don't know what it looks like now. Though I actually came back a couple years ago because I realized I hadn't been here for a while. I thought I'd actually better take a look at it, unless it was markedly different. Somewhat different, but not markedly so.
There's a lot of horticultural details in the Marin County sections that I found interesting that are not so much in the, you know, the Paris sections and the New York sections. I was wondering, what about plant life and trees and describing very specific sort of flora and fauna sort of appealed to you in Marin County? Was it just the kind of mood of where Allison was at, or were you kind of reflecting upon Marin County? Or?
It's simply what's there. She's walking up a mountain with trees and mushrooms and bushes and grasses, so naturally that's what's before the character. That's what she's going to be taking in. But also, I wasn't making a comment about Marin. It was I think useful to me because I don't remember if I thought this out much. Probably not. It was an intuitive choice, I imagine. But it sort of blends well with the theme of decomposition and form and formlessness. Like the when you walk into a, say, a canyon and there's trees falling down, but it's also trees growing up and are extraordinarily bright and powerful. And you can just feel the whole place humming. And then there's other trees that are fallen and dead and leaves are crushed and decaying, especially in the rain. There's a lot of kind of blurring of shapes. And that's also quite beautiful. And that's, but it also has to do with what she's thinking about, which is human beings are born and they're quite vibrant and strong, and then they begin to age, decay, and die. And that those two states are pretty hard for people to understand or to look at without fear or repulsion. So, but that's something that those two things are at play in the book. So I thought whether I thought it out or not, the nature stuff makes sense in that context to me.
Well, this book also shares a sort of similar trait to Two Girls, Fat and Thin, where you have sort of two characters who are kind of at polar opposites of the spectrum. I was wondering if you need this kind of dichotomy to kind of fill in the kind of great range of gray areas that we see in Veronica and we saw in that book as well.
I don't know. I mean, I actually was aware of the, I actually thought, and it could have happened because I didn't read a lot of my reviews, but I bet somebody somewhere wrote a headline that was two girls, one hot, one not. It had to have happened. But I don't know. I didn't think about it. But to me, they, less so with two girls, but with Veronica, the two characters make sense together in a way that on the face of it, they don't. Just one of them is middle-aged. It's unusual for a 21-year-old woman to have a friendship with a woman who's approaching 40, especially one who's not attractive, if the young woman is, and who's had a real different life experience. But on another level, I mean, do you want me to talk about this?
Sure, go for it.
It makes sense. When Allison first meets Veronica, she has she's been kicked out of the modeling world. Allison's like a B-list fashion model, former fashion model at that point. And she's kind of been beat up by the fashion world. So at that moment, she wants nothing to do with it. So she's working as a temp in Manhattan, and that's why she meets this person. And if she'd met her in some other situation, she would probably want nothing to do with her and not have any patience for talking to her. But because they're working together and they're sitting there, they get to know each other more than they would normally. But also think about Allison is someone who does not have a good relationship with her mother. She doesn't feel supported or loved. Her mother's, they don't have a horrible relationship, but it's not one, there's a lot of bonding there. Veronica's an approving, kind, older woman who's giving her a lot of stroking in a very, not unctuous or overbearing way, but just a kind of buoyant approval. And also Allison is quite vulnerable, particularly at that time, because she has been beat up a bit, not physically, but emotionally, and she doesn't have people around her who are kind and nurturing. So she's quite responsive to that, whether she wants to be or not. And then on top of that, Allison is somebody who is not like your average 21-year-old. She's not like an intellectual person, but she's quite sensitive to phenomena around her. And she's been in an environment that where she's experienced a very high level of glamour, sophistication, money, power, and also the abuse of that, rapacity, cruelty, theft. She's had all her money stolen, basically, or most of it. And so most kids don't understand that kind of things on that level. So even though she doesn't understand it on a head level, she understands it on an emotional level. So this woman, she sees it reflected in her. In a very different way, Veronica's experienced some of the same things. Not in as glamorous a level, but she has. And also, Veronica's got a very strong sense of style. Most 21-year-olds, at least put it this way, I at 21 did not have a highly developed sense of style, and I didn't know what to think. I was almost baffled by it. I found it intimidating. Whereas Allison knows it really well. And so when she looks at Veronica, on one hand she finds her grotesque and repellent, but nonetheless she's going to understand that need to construct the self and project a very fixed image.
Sure. Well, the other thing about Allison and Veronica that's interesting, this office environment is almost kind of like sort of a perdition point to a great degree. And one of the things that makes their relationship so interesting, and again, it goes back to this notion of the environment you concentrated in Marin County, is that the environment brings these two together. They're essentially sort of, how much of the environment reflected or motivated the relationship, or vice versa? Was this a conscious design on your part?
Yeah, I did. It was conscious to put them in a setting that was neutral, in which, if you're in a social setting, there's more like expectation or demand or a sense that you have to present yourself or be on, or and you're expecting more from the other person too. Whereas if you're in an office with somebody, it's much more relaxed. Neither one of you has much of a role except as coworker. And so you're going to, should I keep talking?
Oh yeah, keep going. The train's kind of nice, actually.
Okay. It's a kind of environment that you can get to know a person that you wouldn't normally get to know, because it's neutral.
Yeah.
And I did do that on purpose. And that's why I had to make Allison have such a horrible experience as a model, because when I started writing the book, I actually didn't know much about the modeling world. And I had Allison becoming a model at the age of, they're 26 or 28, which is just about impossible. So when I learned that it was just about impossible, I had to have her get into it in her teens, but then have such a ghastly experience that she would want to get out and stay out for a while.
Sure. There's, I know that this novel existed in draft form as far back as 1992, and I also know from an interview that you did with Fail Better that you actually, your vision for this novel didn't change in 10 years, and yet you had to actually sort of develop as a writing voice, as you said in that interview. And yet, there's a school of thought, a predominant school of thought, I would say. Anthony Burgess, for example, once said the novel should be sort of written with a great sort of bout of urgency. But then again, he was a prolific guy. But I was wondering, what is it about this kind of time of ruminating upon a novel that you need to kind of do, and also have such a fixed vision for this book over the course of 10 years is actually quite extraordinary.
It seems like it to me, and I hope it never happens that way again. It was kind of... Although I didn't, for most of that 10 years, I didn't think about it. And I don't totally disagree with what you just quoted. I think there's an element of truth to it, because that's why, you know, that's part of the reason I had trouble getting back into it, though. Because when I first wrote it, maybe you read this too, but when I first wrote it, my usual method of writing is fairly meticulous and slow, and I didn't want that with this book. I did feel it had to be, there was an urgency about it emotionally that I wanted on the page. But so I kind of forced myself to write very rough. And so the first draft was only 100 pages. Like, I left whole chunks out. If I didn't know exactly how to say something, I just put it in a very clumsy way. But the problem was I didn't know what to do with it afterwards. So I think that was part of the challenge and I didn't look at it. It wasn't like I worked on it and revised it for 10 years. I actually didn't look at it for a long time, where I would take it out and look at it and just really have no idea what to do. But I think that the challenge was to maintain the urgency that was in the first draft, but develop it and make it more articulate.
Yeah. What steps did you do to sort of, I guess, keep it urgent, despite the fact that it was this long gestation period?
I don't know if I can answer that, because that's really a matter of stylistic choices that you're making kind of moment to moment. I don't think I could answer it.
I guess also I want to sort of get a sense of, because I also read in another interview that you had, you basically need a kind of 15-minute to 1 hour sort of time to kind of concentrate and dwell upon what you're about to write about. And it's funny, I mean, this kind of actually reminds me very much of how Ed Jones comes up with a story or a novel, where he needs to sit there and think about it and devise the entire thing in his head and then actually write it down. I was wondering if you had a similar kind of conscious process before writing? Or?
It's not conscious in my case. I don't know how to describe it. It's almost not really thinking. It's more like just trying to calm my mind. Even though I seem very placid, I know because I've been told that I have a very placid demeanor. My mind bounces around a lot. It's part of why it takes me so long to write. But it's trying to calm my mind down. So I have to sit to make it just stop bouncing so much.
Are you easily distracted?
Yeah.
Yeah. What steps do you take to remove yourself from all distractions? I mean, you're writing on a computer, I take it, so
I don't always. I actually, for most of my writing life, wrote longhand first, and then would go. I didn't actually get a computer until, and even then, it wasn't really a computer. When I sold my first book, I bought something called a Magnavox Video Writer.
Oh, yeah.
It's like a glorified typewriter.
Yeah.
And I didn't get an actual computer, like most people think of them, until 97. So I would always write out longhand first and then go on the machine. But I have lately been working on the machine, and it's interesting. I don't know if it's good or bad. But what's good about it is it, for some reason, makes you write more loose. It makes you flow a little quicker. But what I don't like about it is that sometimes when I write longhand and I'll write something and I'll decide it's no good and I'll cross it out and I'll write something else. And then when I look back, I see that what I've crossed out is actually better. And on a computer, you delete it. So you don't get to look back and see what you crossed out.
I guess you could always disable the backspace key, I suppose. I don't know.
I've thought of that, but I think it would be just confusing as hell, like to bracket the things and then I don't think I could stand that.
Francine Prose reviewed this book, and she actually had a very interesting observation. She noted that one of Veronica's charms was that it seems to think of itself as a more ordinary novel than it is. And I was wondering, again, going back to sort of, I guess, dichotomy, since that seems to be a theme of this conversation, ordinariness versus extraordinariness, and what you do to... You're a writer who often throws sympathy out the window, I think. And I'm just curious as to whether earlier drafts of Veronica or any of the work you do become sort of more extraordinary, or if this is even an issue for you, or maybe you can talk about this whole ordinary idea that, or by presenting ordinary life, you see these magical sort of extraordinary details, the quotidian kind of...
Well, it's... I suppose I do think of it but mostly about other people. When I'm reading another writer, even if I feel they're technically accomplished, if I feel they have an ordinary mind, I'm often... I wouldn't say I totally lose interest, but it's a something that I don't like to see in a writer. It's almost like you can write about anything in an extraordinary way, not in a showy way, but to write about something extraordinarily, I think, is usually to see it clearly. I don't know what else to say about that. But I'm curious as to why you think I throw sympathy out the window.
Well, I mean, you present these details of these characters in a light that, yes, there is beauty there. There are things that we overlook that are presented here that, you know, I mean, it reminds me very much of, like, you know, A.M. Holmes or William T. Vollman, your work, in the sense that, you know, you present ugliness in a sort of, in a way that we can kind of recontextualize it, in a way that we can sort of come back to it and say, oh, well, there's actually beauty here, or there's, like, beauty in certain aesthetics, or there's beauty in behavior, even though it's ugly behavior. And I suppose that might be something similar to what Francine Prose was saying. And I guess... having the reader come back to that, or in this case, I'm talking about me and I'm rambling, so I'll let you know. But I guess what I'm suggesting here is that there's a kind of, you know, sparse but descriptive kind of nature to your work that allows the reader to kind of latch on emotionally to these aesthetics or these details of the world that we take for granted or we overlook. Maybe you can comment on before I ramble further.
No, that's okay. Well, I ask because I don't feel I don't think there's a character I've ever written that I don't have sympathy for. I don't think it's possible. You wouldn't be interested in writing about the person if you didn't have feeling for them.
Yeah.
And I don't usually. It depends. I mean, but words like ugly or beautiful have a different meaning in an artistic context than they do in walking down the street and seeing something. I think that often it's good to put aside ideas of good or ugly when you're looking at someone, often anyone really, because often if you've got some fixed idea of what's ugly or not, you don't see what's really there.
Sure.
So I don't, it's not that I don't have moral judgments, but I find that really the most sympathetic thing you can do is look at a person for what they are rather than, you know, worrying about whether it's nice or you feel sorry for them or you're on their side, or it's just sort of you can be with them in the moment. That's as sympathetic as one can get, really.
I think what I'm kind of getting at here is that, okay, you as an author, you have sympathy for these characters, and I as a reader, reading Veronica, have sympathy for these characters, but the text itself, the text itself, the medium between the author and the reader, it's rather unsympathetic in the sense that it presents it, and you could feel sympathetic, and then there's this kind of filtering through the text. I think maybe that might be what I'm sort of trying to observe here, I suppose. The way that it's very declarative, all of your sentences, and very, this is the world, throw your own values upon this, or, you know, or do what you will, but this nature of, like, what is ugly is beautiful and what is beautiful is ugly, or you're able to kind of throw the reader off guard through this process, I suppose. Maybe, does the text, do you feel that the text serves as a kind of filter, or is it its own?
I wouldn't think of it that way. Though what you're describing actually sounds to me like somebody doing their job.
Yeah.
Because it's sort of, if you're allowing the reader to have their own feelings about it,
yeah,
that's, I think that's a good thing.
Yeah, yeah. Well, going to this notion of how we view the world, this brings up a point that Benjamin Strong noted in his Village Voice review, where he said, he claimed that you never have been particularly interested in the novel as social or political commentary, and yet there is an unmistakable candor, particularly with women's issues in this book and in your other books, that I particularly find refreshing. I'm wondering, to what extent do you view your novels as sort of social artifacts or social, you know, observations of the world, or is the word social something that is becoming too ideological? Or?
Well, that's an interesting question, and it's complicated. It's hard to answer well. Because I used to, when I was younger, think that social issues had no place in the novel or the short story, and I still do not like books that I feel are, well, that's not even true. I was about to say I don't like books that I feel are didactic, but that's actually not the case. I like a great many books that are didactic. I love Dickens. I can like Dostoevsky. Even George Orwell, he's not a great writer, but didacticism is, it can appear in a great book and not ruin it. It just can become a very kind of vibrant kind of quality to it. But I think that the thing about social concerns is that they do tend to be transitory, but they can give a great deal of energy to something, and also they're just present in the world. I mean, how can you say that you should not write about politics, or you should not write about... Nabokov, who I admire very much, actually made that statement, and that politics have, or they're a silly, it's silly to put them. He put it very elegantly, that somebody asked him why he was hunting for butterflies while World War II was going on, why wouldn't he use his power as a writer to address this crisis, and he said, wars come and go, bugs are forever. Is quite true, but at the same time, it's part of what's happening, and why say that you cannot or should not include that in the spectrum? But in my case, it's kind of like a thread that can go through my work. I don't think it's the major one, and I think that any kind of subject matter, whether it's political or has a strong sociological content or a romantic content or whatever it is, to me, content is like this more on the surface layer of a book, and underneath there's kind of a much more, it's more like a play of fundamental energies that find their expression in the content or themes of the book. So the content could be any number of things. If it interests the writer more, that's good. You know, but still, it's kind of... And I don't... Am I making sense?
No, you are. You are. I mean, the sense I'm sort of getting is that, you know, sometimes something, you know, social is the kind of, I guess, the inspiration that kind of, you know, gets you as the author to sort of, you know, become a little bit more interested in the text that you're writing, to sustain this kind of process where, and to also get to this point of clarity. That's what I'm sort of getting at. That's why I'm sort of concluding from your response here.
So I guess I don't mean in any of my books or stories to provide answers or to questions. Or, I mean, I certainly have quite strong opinions about certain things, but I think that a novel that supplies answers is usually going to be a poor one. It's much better to like kind of put it in front of people and leave them at that moment where they don't know what to think, and have to deal with what they're feeling. I think that's the more powerful thing to do.
Or to perhaps provide a document for the reader. Like, I'm thinking actually of like Jonathan Franzen's introduction to Paula Fox's Desperate Characters in the reissue, where he's like, he basically declares, I wanted, you know, I read this book because I wanted to learn how to live. And that's a really extraordinary statement for anyone to make, but, you know, it presents enough ambiguities in desperate characters, which is, again, a lean book. Just like I think it's kind of applies to your book, there is enough ambiguity there for people to sort of draw their own kind of conclusions or have their own worldview change. Is this something you're aware of when you do this? Is this kind of part of the process of the 10 years it took you to write Veronica?
Well, with everything that I do, everything I've written, I don't know how conscious it is, really. You know, people ask me questions, so that makes me think about it. But it's kind of like I want the reader to be in the situation almost as if it were happening to them and they didn't know quite what they thought or felt. But at some point they will.
So throwing the reader off guard is important to you? Or?
I don't think of it that way. They don't need to be off guard. They just need to be aware and awake and enter into the story.
Going back to this issue of ideology, I mean, I have it here in my notes, but like definitism in Two Girls. There's a sort of like ideology right there that you sort of respond to. It seems to me that ideology is an important component to some degree to your books.
Well, I was satirizing somebody for whom it's the only thing, the only reason to write books. I mean, that's Ayn Rand's books are a big example of what happens when somebody is driven by ideology in their writing. But, you know, you can't deny she had a really, she was amazingly popular and still is.
I saw someone reading Atlas Shrugged on the BART train.
Oh, Atlas Shrugged, I heard once, this was in the 90s, but I wouldn't be surprised if it's still true. Atlas Shrugged was among the 5 top selling books of the in the world.
Wow.
And I'm not surprised.
Yeah.
So it's something that people can respond to, but for me it's... doesn't make a good book, especially artistically speaking.
Yeah, particularly when, you know, anyway, we go into that, but I'd rather talk about your work. I wanted to go back to this issue about dwelling upon sort of the misfits or the isolated types within our society. Veronica, the title character of this. I mentioned, you know, Volman and A.M. Holmes as an example of other authors who do similar sort of things to this, but I'm wondering why this seems to be sort of almost a taboo in contemporary literature and what can be done to sort of to break it, because there aren't really, you know, dealing with issues like, you know, the actual fate of Veronica, which for me was just utterly heartbreaking. Why do you think that there's such a sort of stigma for this, and how do you as an author manage to kind of still navigate or negotiate these waters, because it's all about bestsellers and it's all about like writing an optimistic sort of plot about, you know, upper middle class people?
I don't think that's true. I mean, I guess I'm not sure because I don't have that kind of overview, but it seems to me that writing about sad, terrible things is quite acceptable. Many people like to read sad, hideous stories. I think they prefer, in general, if there's either a really awful ending or an uplifting ending of some kind. I think ambiguity is not and never has been popular, but I think there's no taboo against writing about hideous things. I think what's funny in my case, or what strikes me, is that people seem to act as if I'm writing about something far more terrible than I am. I think that this doesn't apply so much to Veronica, but I was very surprised when Bad Behavior came out and people talked about how dark it was and how shocking. The word shocking was actually used. And it's amazing to me, because in this culture where you turn on the radio and hear people talking about like really obscene stuff, and you go to watch television and you see really, like, there may not be pornography, but it's sex scenes and you see people getting shot. I mean, you see bloody stuff. Kids see bloody stuff all the time. And you pick up a little book of short stories about people who are confused and having trouble relating. That's shocking. I just didn't understand. And I think that probably, it's quite possibly because it's subject matter with a lot of feeling, actually. I've been called cold, but I think actually it's the reverse may be true, that there's too much feeling for some people, and so they feel it almost as a violation of themselves, because rather than the gore fest that they, you know, sat through eating, chomping on popcorn, they actually felt something, and that was what was shocking. I mean, I'm not sure that that's the case, but I've just actually turned it over in my head trying to figure it out, because compared to what this culture is, what I write is just, it's just not that horrific. But I kind of got off the subject.
Oh, no, maybe. No. I mean, we were kind of sort of, I think we were talking pretty much about sort of, well, I was kind of trying to get this, like, I mean, this context that you mentioned. I think maybe that, we were talking about misfits and isolated types and how this is verboten to some degree in the publishing industry, how people don't want to hear about these feelings, perhaps. Maybe it's more that than actual.
Well, I've got an interesting story. I mean, that's not about me, but a friend of mine, a writer named Irini Spanadu, she wrote a book in the 80s called God Snake that did really well, but then her next book, it took her 10 years to write it, and it didn't get a whole lot of attention. And she just wrote a book, and she turned it into her editor, and her editor actually said to her, it needs to be funnier, there needs to be more irony, it's depressing. And Irini just kind of, she didn't blow up or yell, but she was just like, are you crazy? Look at the world. Look at what's going on around us. Funny? I don't think this is funny. People are depressed. People are frightened. People are sad and confused. How do you think it's beneficial to me to be writing? If I was a person who naturally wrote light and funny and ironic, that would be one thing. But for me to try and make myself like that, that doesn't reflect reality. And the editor actually listened to her. Amazingly, the editor actually backed off and let her do what she wanted to do, which I really applaud, because it's like so much. My friend's book, it's got a kind of depth and power to it that isn't just about being, you know, seeing a horrible sight. It's got some real emotional heft to it, and I was glad that she stood up for it, because I think people actually do know that that's real.
Well, perceived reality versus real reality, whatever it might be, is actually a big theme in this book. You have, like, for example, Allison is sort of saying, oh, I have this notion of what Paris is like. And you have, like, you know, this is a real dancer and things like this. Real is a constant sort of word throughout this book. Maybe what we're talking about here is how people, I mean, there are multiple perceptions of something. And if you, like, play it up for, like, a gore fest, I mean, easily this could have been sort of contextualized perhaps into some sort of, like, you know, cheap kind of satirical sort of device about, like, models and whatnot. But it's the actual sort of, like, perception that we're talking about. Is this something that you sort of strive to, I mean, what steps do you do to kind of, like, you know, ensure that kind of perception is there, of darkness, of seeing things for what they are, at least in this context?
Well, I don't know if there's any steps you can take to do that, really, except when I teach writing, I haven't said this in a while, but I used to say to my students when they were describing anything, a conversation, a scene, or I would say, I want to hear this or see this written as only you could see it. I don't want to see it the way you think 10 other people saw it, or I want to see it through your eyes, only your eyes. And I gave up on saying it because I just seemed to exhaust them. But I think that's what a writer needs to do when they locate themselves in any moment in their book. What, I mean, and sometimes nobody looks at everything really intently all the time. But whatever is the essence of that scene, I want to see it in a way that only that writer can give it to me. And that's what I try to do.
You have to get going. So anyway, it was a pleasure to chat with you.
Thanks
a lot.